Welcome to our listeners. I'm your host, Jude Al-Qurani. I'm a PhD candidate at the University of Toronto's Department for the Study of Religion and Center for Diaspora and Transnational Studies. The Reading Muslims Project at the Institute of Islamic Studies is a Connaught Global Challenge recipient. Its mandate is to interrogate the place of textuality within Islamic studies. One of its areas of focus is Islam and anthropology. To this end, today we have with us Dr. Nada Mumtaz. We're honored to have her with us. Since 2016, Dr. Mumtaz has served as assistant professor at the University of Toronto's Department for the Study of Religion and Department of Near and Middle Eastern Civilizations. In Dr. Mumtaz's own words, her work stands at the intersection of Islamic legal studies, the anthropology of Islam, and studies of capitalism, spanning the 19th and 21st centuries in the Levant. Dr. Mumtaz completed her dissertation at the City University of New York, where she examined the contemporary Islamic revival of a centuries-old charitable practice of pious endowment, also known as the Waqf, under global capitalism and a regime of modern nation-states. Based on her dissertation, Dr. Mumtaz's first book is entitled God's Property, Islam, Charity, and the Modern State, and it'll be available from University of California Press in April 2021. Described as a historical anthropology in dialogue with Islamic law, Dr. Mumtaz's book and her research more broadly provide us an excellent opportunity to start thinking through some of the questions we hope to explore in the larger Reading Muslims project, of which Dr. Mumtaz is a leading contributor. So thank you, Dr. Mumtaz, for joining us. So I'll start off with the first question, and you can take it in any direction you please. So we've talked before on this podcast about how the project of Reading Muslims explores the politics of textuality in studies of Islam. So early anthropologists of Muslim societies, whether Geertz or Gilsonen or Gellner, they aim to distinguish themselves from Orientalists by focusing on Islam as practiced by lay people on the ground rather than as analyzed by intellectuals in their writing. And then in response, we had Talal Asad remind anthropologists of, you know, how his texts are central to the Islamic tradition and inspiring scholars after him to examine how texts are embodied in practice and debated among individuals and communities. So I'd like to ask you, as an anthropologist working in a discipline shaped by these conceptual legacies and methodological legacy, how would you understand anthropology's relation to textuality today? And on a related note, what would you say are some unique challenges that anthropologists face when trying to engage texts in their research? And do you find anything distinct about the place of Islamic texts within anthropology in particular? And I turn the mic over to you.
I tried to say thank you after you introduced me, but I couldn't unmute myself. I felt like there was something blocking me. Anyways,
it is our pleasure.
Thank you so much for having me. And for these very thoughtful questions, I would say that anthropology has been, you know, moving towards being much more capacious and makes definitely space for the use of texts. But I do still feel like a lot of the approaches to methods and the kind of lot of set of definitions of anthropologists put a lot of emphasis on ethnography. And so in some ways, if your interlocutors don't bring up texts, then it sometimes becomes more difficult to perhaps, you know, bring them in ways that might feel to readers that they kind of, you know, belong to such a genre of writing, particularly the ethnographic. And so, you know, yeah, I feel like there's still a bit of a fetish for ethnography, I would say. And I think that in terms of, you know, the textuality and the using texts, engaging texts as part of your research, I think that there's a real challenge in terms of engaging in depth a tradition that is so vast. Mm-hmm. And I think that is probably the hardest aspect of it. I mean, you have enough on your plate trying to understand what is going on in the field and keeping, you know, in touch and, you know, following people around, etc. And engaging with and learning about the texts of the tradition is itself kind of a project in and of itself. And so I feel like this could be, you know, it's very time consuming. It's not necessarily easy. And, you know, for people who are trained in that tradition, it is a lifelong commitment. And, you know, so acquiring fluency in the textual tradition is an endeavor that is as time consuming as, you know, becoming an anthropologist. And it's hard to keep both while doing research. And Yeah, so I would say that this is probably I would find the hardest. And then the other thing I wanted to address is the question of, you know, the distinct place of Islamic text within anthropology. And here I also wondered, you know, how much we need to emphasize texts themselves. And, you know, while texts are definitely important, but they're also, let's say, invoked in ways that are not necessarily, you know, through text. So they can be embodied, they can be brought up in conversations without a reference to the text. So I would say that, you know, there's not, I mean, so while texts are important, I would say because anthropology makes us attuned to embodiment, to, you know, the way people talk about things, the way they act, the way, you know, it does their sensibilities, etc. This is something that might perhaps remind us that texts do not always take a particular shape that we'd expect, which is, you know, like they're going to be citing X, Y, or Z, etc. So that would be, I think, something that is distinct about anthro and the way it can deal with texts in a way that texts that are not necessarily obvious, perhaps.
Yeah, that's great to think with. And also, I think you're pointing to kind of the fact that just sort of giving these texts their due is essentially a full-time job in itself and a full-time kind of education. And considering the, you know, material constraints that so many scholars and anthropologists in particular today face in terms of, you know, funding cuts and budgetary issues and, you know, lack of research travel and grants and kind of asking them to do all of what they need to do, plus also, you know, approaching the tradition from a completely different perspective than they've been taught is sometimes can be an overwhelming perspective, I would say, especially for, you know, younger scholars that are still establishing themselves in the field. But I appreciate kind of your move to not exceptionalize Islamic texts or kind of the text itself as a, you know, written form, or whether it's, you know, pen on paper or a more digital version of that. And I mean, I might want to maybe skip to kind of my question that I wanted to ask you a little bit later, but kind of speaking in terms of how texts can take on different forms that aren't necessarily, you know, what we would think of as a traditional text. How does that figure into your work and your research and your field work? Because, I mean, as far as I understand, you are someone who actually does work with, you know, the kind of old school definition of an Islamic text or a legal text or a, you know, text produced by the state. And so how does, you know, how do Islamic texts figure into your field and your field work? And then also in your writing? And then how do you kind of mediate between those two embodiments of the text or materializations of the text?
Thank you, Jude. That was a good kind of move since we're talking about the question of, you know, what texts look like. In my research, it was very text heavy, as you say, and very, very different forms of texts. You know, I attended classes at the Sharia school in Beirut, and so I was dealing with the texts of the tradition in a particular kind of tradition. And it was interesting because I could also see how, you know, it was certain kinds of texts, say Shafi'i texts, were more used for ibadat, which is kind of worship, and whereas Hanafi texts were more used for talking about certain pecuniary transactions, muamalat, but even some marriage divorce things were also under the Hanafis. And this is because of the historical dominance of the Hanafi school in the Ottoman Empire, under which Lebanon was before it was Lebanon, basically. It was, you know, when it was Beirut. And so I was getting a certain sense of the living tradition and the way it was taught, etc., in that cottage. But I was also working in the archive of the Sharia court in Beirut. And so I was encountering an enormous archive of Sharia court records that were kept in the court itself. And what's interesting is that these court records from the 19th century were kept in the same room as the contemporary ones. So it, in some ways, the Sharia court remained alive, and these records are not of a past that's completely now, you know, past. And the judges sometimes might actually look and try and find a certain case or a certain waqf document, etc., in this archive from the 19th century. So that was also one of the sites, and that involved, you know, this archive. And that's what Messick would call, you know, the archive. And the first one that I was dealing with in the Sharia college would be what he would call the library. And the library, which involves much more texts written in the abstract and that are written to summarize particular rules, etc. And whereas the archive, they're specified for particular times and places, the other ones in the library are much more abstracted. And so I was getting a sense of both of these in my field work. And then I was also, the other archive also was like, these documents that families kept, whether it was, say, deeds for their waqf founded by their forefathers or their foreparents or their ancestors, let's say, and sometimes lawsuit documents, all of these, you know, texts that embodied Islamic tradition in various forms. And then there was also discussions I was having also with people about what counts as a waqf. And these were not necessarily perhaps drawing explicitly on saying, okay, well, Ibn Abidin says this and, you know, whatever. And so they were not necessarily referencing these older texts that I was getting familiarized with on my own, but also from archive of the Sharia court. And yeah, so basically there was all of these like three different lenses that were refracting what counts as a text and what are the various texts that are available, and basically letting me see things I wouldn't have seen without one or the other. So that's kind of, you know, part that was, I feel like, most useful to me, is to place these various texts and the way they are talked about also in what I call the notebook, which is, you know, my ethnographic notes based on observations, putting them in dialogue. And they were triggering questions to each other. And so even in the archive itself, you know, there were they cited texts that are considered part of the Islamic legal tradition. And so that is what allowed me to kind of discover what is the library in the 19th century, which is different from, as I mentioned, the texts that are right now used in the Sharia court, in the Sharia college. So, so that's why when I was writing, in fact, it was an interesting process, because I was using the Sharia courts to also figure out what was the canon of, I mean, I call it canon loosely, but to say kind of the main texts that the judges were referencing. It's not actually the judges, because it's really a bit more complicated. Now we're getting into details, but here we go. A lot of these lawsuits, for example, might have fatwas, which are legal opinions given by scholars. And in these legal opinions, they would then buttress their opinion by citing certain authoritative texts. And so that's what allowed me to figure out what was authoritative back in the 19th century. And so I was found myself reading these books on my own, because not all of them were there. And the other thing that also happened was that I was also able to find in, say, the Waqf Directorate, certain books from the 19th century that are still alive. So in the same way that in the Sharia court, there's like these alive archive, there's also the certain texts from the tradition that are alive because they are still being used and referenced today. So it told you also the change in what are the authoritative texts of the tradition at different points and how that changes as well, particularly because there's all of these also state legislations that come in with the French mandate in Lebanon that kind of switch around the possibility of using some texts from the Islamic legal tradition, because they become less relevant since now it's codified in a certain way. But also that's where actually the more interesting stuff happens, which is talking to people and to and sometimes there's newspaper articles, etc. Even some of these opinions and texts that were silenced by legislation sometimes arise and inform public debate. And so even if the law, the state law, silenced certain and codified certain opinions, the tradition and the opinions present therein in these texts, this kind of, you know, these texts which are perhaps not as present in the daily lives of people anymore, are still present in within a certain scholarly community, and they then draw on them to make arguments and they become relevant again. So it kind of is like all very intertwined. That was a long answer, and I didn't even address the question of translation, because that's also so, that was extremely difficult for me, because a lot of the texts are also, you know, it's they're legal texts. So the question becomes then, do you translate them into the more common modern legal terms that, you know, we are used to or not? And would that be bringing assumptions with it from the readers? So, and so there's this big tension between trying to, you know, make this accessible and not this, you know, very exceptional, very different, irrelevant, let's say, way of doing things, but also trying to remind the reader that these are also basically trying at the same time to keep the specificity, but at the same time say this is relevant and this can make us think differently about things. So, yeah, particularly in legal terms, and it becomes, you know, very tricky, because lawyers, for example, would say, yeah, this is law at the end, and so you should just use the common terminology today. But since law worked differently and had different assumptions with it, particularly, say, you know, the fact that it's God's law makes a difference. And so, yeah, so a lot of detail for you.
I mean, this detail is wonderful. And I guess these are the questions that are at the heart of your book, right? And they're extremely important, and especially for, I mean, for any scholar that's interested in Islam and kind of the modern, you know, modern state and the relationship between them. But also for, you know, anyone who's tuning into us, anyone involved in the Reading Muslims project, because, I mean, your work is just fundamentally interdisciplinary and kind of taking the questions and assumptions and methods of each discipline into directions that it's not necessarily been taken before, I would say. And so I'm curious, you know, just if you have a second, or, you know, we don't have to go too much into detail about this, but I mean, you're approaching Islamic legal texts, but you're approaching them from an anthropological perspective, an ethnographic perspective. And so what does that mean for you to kind of read these texts or attend these, you know, classes in the Sharia College as an anthropologist, as an ethnographer? What are you kind of looking for? How do you see differently with that lens than someone else who just, you know, is interested in the sort of text aspect of it? If you can speak to that, maybe.
Yeah, that's a good question. And definitely, I think that is what distinguishes my work, say, from, say, social historians who also use the same records. You know, like the Sharia court records have been mined by social and political historians, social and economic historians particularly, and they've done so much important work to kind of illuminate the lives of people in the 19th century, because they give you much more of a texture to the everyday. And even though, of course, a lot of them are very generic and they follow, as Messick, again, one of my heroes, you know, puts it, they have they're scripted, you know, so they're not like, you know, free form and people are just expressing themselves in them and we just get a glimpse, you know, it is very scripted. But still within that, you can get different, you know, you can get at more details of the economy and, you know, relations between people and they, say, how people understood property, you know, things like that. But so my questions to these texts were a lot very different. So I was not trying to say, for example, who did what? Was it mostly women? Was it mostly men? What does it tell us? I mean, and these are really essential. And the only reason I am able to do the work I do is because some historians have done the work they've done. So they give us already a certain picture of the way Waqf was done. And in Beirut, it is local historian, her name is Aurore Adada, who did her PhD in France, and she actually did all of that social history. And I'm really grateful to her work. She was my history teacher, actually, in Lebanon. It's kind of crazy. But yes, and anyway, so I was saying that this is my work then asks different questions, which are much more about, say, the assumptions in them, or how people understood, say, waqf there, or how people approached property. And, you know, so these are the things that I am more interested in terms of the questions I ask of these documents. And I'm interested in the way certain concepts in these texts are used with other concepts, and what they kind of help us then understand the meaning of these words. And then I look at their change, the way these constellations change through time, and the way this has to do with, say, changing understand the role of the state, understandings of private and public, etc., and the place of God in all of this. And so, yeah, my questions to them differ because I'm not doing an economic and social history based on these texts.
Thank you, Neda. I'm sure I'm not alone in this, but I'm very much looking forward to reading this book. But I'm curious, as you've been writing it now, has there been, you know, one or two, you know, recent ethnographies of Muslim societies, of Islam, that engage Islamic texts in a way that you found helpful? And if so, which ones? And what is it about them that stands out?
I mean, to be honest, Jude, that was the hardest question for me. And I couldn't find an answer for you. I mean, the thing that to me, the foundational work is Messick in terms of mm-hmm. approaching texts and the way he reads and he read with his interlocutors. And, you know, I was thinking, I haven't read more in detail, but I can't think of any. I mean, there's people on my list that I haven't read. I mean, I've read parts of, but I haven't read all of. Like, I think Arya and Akisa did something similar in Azhar, and he was reading with, you know, teachers, etc. And then he has published some pieces that deal with texts, but are informed by his conversations with those teaching such texts. So I think that all of these were very much informed by what I feel like is Messick's kind of reading with, you know, as a method. And that is not something, for example, that I've done as much, because I didn't read a lot of these texts with my interlocutors, because, as I said, the 19th century canon that I dealt with was not very much alive today. Mm-hmm. So I think these are the interesting ethnographic kind of approaches to, you know, using texts, to reading texts with and along. Yeah, so that's kind of, I don't have much more than that.
mm-hmm. No, I mean, I wonder if the question can be a bit difficult to answer, because maybe it's not necessarily so common to engage texts so fundamentally, ethnographies of Islam or of Muslim societies.
I was actually looking, I was looking at different, you know, works that have been done. For example, I pulled out Stefania Pandolfo's book. I pulled out Nermin Muftah's latest article on Quran lessons. And it was interesting to see how they use them. And it's, yeah, I mean, I think this brings me to the question of which text do we choose to engage from the Islamic tradition is a very difficult question to answer, I think. And I think that's where perhaps getting cues from your interlocutors becomes important to say. But there's also an excavation work that, you know, if you have a very deep knowledge of the tradition, you can perhaps also, or you can excavate, say, a certain position. For example, in Nermin's article, it was about whether pronouncing ta, ta, you know, does that invalidate prayer? And so Nermin excavates, you know, some opinions on that, etc. And these are interesting because they kind of allow us to understand where these sensibilities and the sphere of that teacher about having taught her students the wrong pronunciation come from, and the sins she might accrue, and the fact that she's invalidating their prayers, etc. So it helps kind of ground that feeling. But the question then becomes, why do we choose to engage particular texts and not others? And what are the texts that inform our interlocutors' ideas of, you know, Islam? And that is, you know, if you're dealing with people who are engaged in the tradition, you might have study circles, you might, there might be actually texts that are circulating and that give you an insight into these texts that matter. And yeah, so it depends also on who you're studying. So if you're studying, like Anna Vinia, for example, works on Quranic healers. And so she, for example, can, you know, work with them because they have their own libraries that she can draw on as well and, you know, and get insight from.
Mm-hmm. So I also think it's a question of kind of how do we define Islamic texts? Because I mean, I know from my own interlocutors, sometimes they kind of understand their Islam or come to their Islam through texts that would not traditionally be defined as Islamic texts. So self-help books, for instance, you know, books like The Secret or, you know, Deepak Chopra helps them understand Islam. So how do we understand Islamic texts is also up for question, I would say.
Absolutely. Yeah, I think that's also a very, you know, I think you bring out this question again about, you know, authority and what's authoritative. Mm-hmm. And I think that's really essential. And, you know, I brought out the archive and all of these Sharia court records. And of course, these are a different genre. They are informed, etc. But yeah, like, you know, people are not going to come and tell you like these are Islamic texts necessarily. But yeah, but I think you bring out this question of the self-help books and the kind of more popular or, you know, popularizing books and their authority and who gets to decide what is authoritative or not. How does their authority kind of, you know, congeal and how do they, yeah, how do they interpolate people? And is a quite important question.
And how do anthropologists recognize them as one thing versus another as well? How do we see them when we're studying them?
And again, that's one of these questions that I think that's where anthropology is great, because you can actually look at things and see how people are talking about these texts and what they consider, you know, authoritative or not. And that in ways people who don't deal with real people don't have access to. So I think it gives us, you know, ethnography, despite my kind of being annoyed at its fetishization, it can be very useful.
No, and I think especially, I mean, this takes us, I think, to our last question, which is, I mean, again, the Reading Muslims Project, the kind of fundamental aspect of it is that it is so interdisciplinary, right? And we're approaching these same questions from very different angles. And so as an anthropologist, what do you find most engaging about this project? What are you excited about? And what is the purpose of it in your perspective, again, as an anthropologist?
Yeah, I mean, before I answer this, I just also wanted to tell you one of the, I think the important questions about, you know, who decides on, you know, what is authoritative. And I think, again, the question of the place of the anthropologists and their relation to the tradition and who, whether they can actually describe, I mean, we have a relation to the tradition, whether one is part of it, whether one, you know, is completely not compelled by it. And these, of course, affect the way one reads the tradition. But I think that's where there's a space for anthropologists to speak in ways that would be foreclosed to see, say, me as a Muslim, that I wouldn't be able to speak the way I would speak if I were not an anthropologist. And it's so I think that's also an important aspect when approaching texts and speaking about the tradition. And even though there is circulation of texts from anthropology, and you can think about Asad's work being translated into Arabic and being picked up in Egypt by a certain Islamist, etc. And I think there's that circulation. I mean, so I think what I'm trying to say is that, you know, even though we are outside of these circles to a large extent, there is still some places where there can be some circulations as well and feedbacks between anthropology, which posits itself as outside, and some outside, say, yeah, like debates internal to the tradition. And even though Asad says very clearly that he is, you know, writing about the tradition is to be in relation with it, and he says that, yeah, I am a Muslim, and so yeah, but I think, of course, it's opening certain ways of speaking about the tradition that might not be possible, I would say, in different circumstances.
That's a great way to look at it.
But the other thing is, I mean, what the question of the reading Muslims, I think it's, you know, it's exciting because of the possibility to work across time and methods. And so, for example, working with philologists and medievalists that usually we don't engage with. And I think there's like, you know, ways of reading that they can, you know, help anthropologists see, and that could be exciting as well. And the other part of the project also is kind of the lives of the Islamic texts in the West, for example, in, you know, these court cases or in, you know, and how they are used to discipline Muslims or, you know, and I think that's also a super fascinating kind of, you know, thinking about the lives of these texts is something that I feel like could be very generative, and thinking about how we approach them differently, you know, as medievalists or people who are interested in them as, you know, philologists or as anthropologists or as, you know. So, yeah, so I think these are some of the exciting things to me about this project.
Well, thank you. Thank you, Neda. Well, we're very happy and glad that you're part of the project, one of the leaders of the Ethnographic Methods Hub. And thank you for taking the time to talk with us today.
Thank you, Jude, for having me and for these this fun conversation.
Thank you, Neda. So thank you all, everyone, for listening. We hope you enjoyed this Reading Muslims podcast, and we hope that you tune in to our next ones coming up soon.